Welcome to Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice and great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, here's the number to call, 1-800-462-7413. Zorba, along with our callers, some interesting topics to talk over?
Yes, we're going to talk about cuddling. Is it more important to men or to women? We're going to talk about some research on that. And dads, are they as good at recognizing their baby's cry as moms? Some fascinating research on that topic.
I don't know what I'd guess on that. What's our recipe?
Our recipe, breakfast tortillas. It's a wonderful breakfast recipe. It's simple, but you know what? Sometimes the simplest recipes can be the best recipes. I happen to love breakfast, and you will find this recipe one of the best.
Our toll-free number is 800-462-7413. And Zorba, to the phones we go now. A listener with us in Lexington, Kentucky. Hi.
Hi, Tom and Zorba. First-time caller, and appreciate your show, and thanks for taking my call.
Sure. How can we help you?
Well, here's the situation. I work for the YMCA, and the Lexington YMCA, along with a couple other YMCAs, are going to Vietnam, and we are going to be traveling there to build a YMCA school in Vietnam. So it's a great project, and we're excited. I'll be leaving in a few days. And so here's what happened is I went to the doctor, and I told him, I said, hey, I'm traveling to this region of the world. What do I need to get? So what kind of vaccines? And he gave me three vaccines that day, which were hepatitis A, hepatitis B, and tetanus. And about 24 hours later, after receiving those three shots, I got to feeling really, really bad, just sore throat, headache, extreme fatigue. And this has gone on now for 2.5 weeks. And I guess my question to you, is there any possible way that I actually, that he gave me hepatitis?
Well, there are a couple of things that have gone on. First of all, when you get a vaccine, and hepatitis A, hepatitis B, tetanus, they're all dead vaccines. So there's no virus in there that is actually going to affect you. And what happens is when you get a vaccine, the next day, 2 days, 3 days, 4 days, a week later, your body is mounting an immune response to that vaccine. And it's actually better to get more vaccines at the same time than fewer because the immune response sort of is additive with all of them together. But at any one time, especially during the wintertime, but at any one time in our society, 1% or 2% of the population is coming down with something. So if you get a shot and the next day you were going to be coming down with something, you always blame it on the shot that you had before. So it's very, very difficult sometimes to separate out the side effects that may occur from the vaccine from a coincidental disease. Do you follow what I'm saying?
But you're not saying there are no side effects to the vaccine.
No, but I don't know. The most common side effect is for 24 or 48 hours to people have a mild fever. That is not an uncommon side effect at all. Pain at the site is a common side effect. Not feeling good. Not for 2 to 3 weeks. In other words, that's beyond what you would expect from the vaccines. Family history of anything, any arthritises, rheumatic arthritis or Crohn's disease, something called collagen diseases, anything like that?
No Crohn's disease, a little bit of arthritis on my mother's side, but, you know, she's now 82 or 3, so.
So not young arthritis that's there. No. And you're still feeling crummy from all this, it sounds like.
Yeah. I mean, the tiredness has gotten a little better. It was so, you know, there were several days I went home at 3 o'clock and just went to bed, but that's gotten a little bit better. But last night, just had a really debilitating headache, and I was like, man.
There's something else going on. I do not think this is from the immunizations. I just don't
really think
so. It doesn't make sense. Now, keep in mind, when it comes to immunizations, people have very strong ideas about it. They will get passionate about the fact that immunizations cause lots of side effects. And at one time, I was passionate about it, considering some of the side effects. But I think you've got to look somewhere else if this thing continues. I would still give it a week or two to see what happens. But if not, you may want to get a second opinion on this.
Okay. All right. Well, great. I hope you guys Have a good week, and I appreciate your call, taking the time for the call.
And have a really good time in Vietnam.
Oh, thank you, Tom.
Yep. Bye-bye.
Bye.
800-462-7413, toll-free. To Milwaukee, Wisconsin, we go now, Zorba. Hi.
Hey, guys. How are you?
Fine. How can we help?
Well, I've got two questions. The first one, has anyone ever told you guys that your show is extremely relaxing to listen to while on the beach drinking beer?
No, wait a minute. No, wait a minute. You're saying that we tend to put people to sleep?
Well, not to sleep. My wife and I were in Aruba recently, and you get a lot of beach time in Aruba. And, you know, I'd crack a couple of those bolaches that they have down there, the Aruban beer. And kick up my feet, throw on my Zorba Pastor podcast, and I was on my way to relaxation.
Well, good.
I love it. I love
any
it.
Any way
Thank
we
you.
Can satisfy, we're happy to do it.
So my real question is regarding anti-epileptic medications in pregnancy.
Mm-hmm.
My wife was recently put on Keppra for epilepsy, 500 milligrams twice a day. And we want to have a baby. We're not pregnant yet. But we want to know which anti-epileptic medications are the safest to be on while pregnant and also after, so while breastfeeding. Her neurologist had recommended both Keppra or Lamictal,
mm-hmm.
and both look to increase the risks of developmental disorders in pregnancies. And my wife turns 35 next week, so I guess that already kind of throws her into the at-risk category. But we're both very, very healthy people. We exercise daily. We eat a very healthy diet. And we're really just trying to do all that we can to bring a healthy baby into the world. And, you know, this was kind of scary when we found out that it kind of increased the risk. So is one Keppra or Lamictal, or is there a different one that's safer to be on? And can you safely breastfeed well on them?
Oh, sure, sure. Well, let's put this into, you know, into a perspective. First of all, your wife is 35, so that puts her at higher risk for Downs. Very specific,
okay.
Very different situation with women between 35 and 40 when we do, prenatal testing. We're really doing prenatal testing for an older woman looking for Down syndrome. Not related to this at all. Very
okay.
separate. Different situation. Now, when it comes to risk with any medication, there's a pregnancy category. What you want to do is go to your local pharmacy and you want to say which anti-seizure drugs are safe. That's one way to do it. The other way to do it is to go on the net and look it up, because the pregnancy categories are all very, very specific. And there are two websites. You could go either to the PDR, Physician's Desk Reference, or you could go to Epocrates. You can download Epocrates on your smartphone, your iPad, and you know on your regular computer. And then what you want to do is you want to go through the various seizure medications. Now, your neurologist may know which ones are safer. The problem is, you're going to work in a little bit of a gray zone. In other words, is there a possibility it may cause a developmental disorder, or is there a probability? And what you want to do, because obviously your wife does not want to have seizures, you want to use the drug that is the safest within it, but it's probably not going to be pristine. And that means that maybe 1 out of 1,000 people may have reported a possible side effect with this drug, and it may be related to the drug. There are all the maybes in there.
Yeah.
Because there's never going to be a double-blind study on the drug to look at safety. Never.
Okay.
So,
thank you guys so much. We've looked all over, and we wanted to let the search stop with Zorba. We really respect you guys, and you guys do a wonderful job.
When you guys were on the beach in Aruba listening to the podcast, I hope Zorba wasn't doing one of his rants on the dangers of being in the sun.
Very well, maybe. You know, I mean, there was points when maybe, you know, I was getting a little too relaxed and dozing off, and, you know, Zorba's very friendly laugh would wake me out of my slumber.
Well, good. I'm glad you enjoyed it and glad you had us with you. Wish we could have really been there. Bye-bye.
Thank you guys so much.
800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. Research Zorba. On cuddling, men and women.
Yes, yes. Well, despite, you know, we've got these traditional beliefs that women are more interested in cuddling than men, but there's a new study that shows that cuddling and caressing is really more important to men than to women. Now, it's study that came out of the Kinsey Institute. Mm-hmm. We know the Kinsey Institute has been involved in sexual research for at least 50 years. Mm-hmm. And they were surprised to find out that more men reported being happy in their relationships with cuddling than women. And women who were in relationships for 10 to 20 years were much more likely to be sexually satisfied often than men in those relationships. And so I think the study is kind of interesting in that, you know, we have this view, this sort of biased view that men are interested in sex and women are interested in cuddling, when in fact it's really a mixture of both. You know, it's really a
mixture. Did I misunderstand
you?
Men reported they were more interested in cuddling than women.
Correct.
But women were, did you say, more sexually satisfied?
No. Well, women who had been in relationships for 10 or 15 years were often more sexually satisfied than men. That's what they found as a side effect of the study.
Not by cuddling, I guess.
In general, that's what they found. So, but I think what's interesting kind of about the study is that it's really a mixture when you're in long-term relationships of cuddling on one hand and sex on the other side, and that movies often dissuade us into thinking that men are just interested in sex and women are the touchy-feely ones when it's actually
well,
both things
together.
I don't
know if it's just movies. I mean, this really is counterintuitive because I think the general perception, maybe not just from movies, but generally we think of women being more interested in cuddling.
That's right. And so what the study throws out is that, especially when you're having trouble in relationships, that the trouble that may be occurring in relationships, and not all relationships have a 15-year lifespan where everyone is satisfied at the end of 15 years. Quite the contrary. You know, divorce, of course, is always a huge issue in society. That maybe it's a combination of cuddling and sexual relationship, especially when they get married and throughout the years, that is really a combination together. And this bias that we have that men are interested in sex and women are interested in cuddling, we have to throw that out and say that's not the case.
But this is men reporting and women could be men are just trying to seem to be more touchy-feely.
Oh, you mean this is a fake
really
report?
Are. Yeah,
men really are not.
I don't know. I'm just
so
saying.
Men are really not interested in cuddling. Men are saying they're interested in cuddling because they want to say the right thing to the questioners.
I'm just saying.
People might actually lie on these questionnaires? They might not tell their deep-seated truth.
Oh no, I don't know what I was thinking of. I don't know what I was thinking. 1-800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. Now Zorba, a listener with us in Terre Haute, Indiana. Hello.
Hi, Tom and Dr. Zorba. How are you today?
Fine. What's up?
Well, I have an unusual skin condition. It's kind of a mysterious condition that I'd like to ask for Dr. Zorba's advice.
Mm-hmm.
Last summer, I worked in my yard really hard, and I got some pretty severe blisters on both of my hands from digging. And the blisters were normal. They went away. They're completely healed. And this past fall and winter, they have reappeared, not as blisters, but just as the healed kind of scaly, flaky skin that you get when the blister's healing. And it's the same exact locations that I had the blisters before. And I thought, okay, that's strange, but no big deal. They'll probably go away. Well, they haven't gone away.
Uh-huh. What have you put on it?
I've put lotion. I use lip balm. And sometimes when I use my lip balm, I'll put it on there because it's more emollient. And that makes it feel better, and it makes the some of the flaky skin go away, but the texture of the skin is still strange.
Mm-hmm. Did you put on a steroid cream at all?
No, I haven't tried that.
Uh-huh. Well, I'll tell you something about blisters and rashes that are interesting. First of all, they're really difficult to look at over the radio. That's number one. You can't always figure it out. But what's common is common. And many of us have contact allergies to a whole bunch of things. And that's why starting with a simple over-the-counter hydrocortisone cream, which is not very strong, incredibly weak, but you don't have to go to the doctor, is often the first place to start. And if that doesn't work, I think I'd go see somebody. Your family doc would often be able to answer their question. Often steroid creams, sometimes an antifungal cream or a combination of an antifungal cream and steroid cream can really make a difference. But it's sounds to me, especially the change in texture, that you may be something that we call lichenification, which is – lichenification is a texture on top of the skin that often occurs when you've got a dermatitis or an eczema condition that is simply not attended to. Soap, what kind of soap do you use in the shower and in the bath?
I use body wash, just, mm-hmm. you know, standard from the department store.
Okay, what you want to do is make sure if you have a deodorant body wash, it's going to be drier to your skin and it's more likely to aggravate this. When you wash dishes, do you wash dishes?
Yes.
Do you use gloves when your hands are in the sink?
No.
You should use gloves. Makes a big difference.
Okay.
You get get gloves, get an extra large in the glove, put it on all the time. Huge difference in your hands. I started using gloves years ago in the wintertime. My hands were going to get dry and crack. Once I started using gloves, that made a big difference because the detergent that breaks down the grease on your plates and in your dishes also breaks down the keratin, which is on top of your hands. That makes a huge difference, and that can do it. So I'd wear gloves when washing dishes, over-the-counter hydrocortisone cream. If that fails, go to your doc and get a diagnosis.
All right, great. Thank you so much.
Sure, appreciate the call. Have you ever heard, Zorba, that getting blisters, the blisters healing, and then later on, months later, the skin becoming irritated in the same place?
Often what happens is our body has a memory. So sure, you can come into contact. You know, look, you come into contact with something you're allergic to, and you may not get rid of it for a while. It may kind of flare and come and go because the body sort of has a memory as to what's going on with your skin. But yes, and that's exactly where you've got to have somebody who looks at it and figures it out.
Mm-hmm. Before we take a short break, Zorba, let's see if you're up for another round of Stump the Doc. Our contestant today is Renee from Boyceville, Wisconsin, who has a problem with loud noises. So let's keep it down. Renee writes, "Hi, Zorba and Tom. Keep up the good work on your show. I always enjoy listening to you guys. Anyway, I have a health-related question for you. I'm a person who very much dislikes unexpected loud noises. I'm usually a very easygoing person, but when a loud noise startles me, I get irritated instantly. Probably most people have this same problem, but here's the strange thing about me. Whenever I hear a loud, unexpected noise, my eyesight goes blurry for about 1 second. This has happened to me for as long as I can remember. I'm 31 years old and have never had any serious health issues. Over the years, I've described this phenomenon to my family and friends, and no one seems to share this trait with me. Is this common? Why does this happen?"
Well, I don't think it's common at all. I don't think most people hear loud noises have a visual disturbance that's associated with it. But there are interesting reflexes that happen. For example, if you go from a dark parking lot into bright light suddenly, a lot of people sneeze. It's a reflex.
A lot of people sneeze at bright light, if you're not in a dark park. Look out the window and the sun
bright
on
lights.
My eyes, I
That's
tend
right.
to sneeze
That's
sometimes.
Right. tend
yeah.
to sneeze. Yeah. So this may be a very similar reflex that's actually occurring with a loud, startling noise, and that's what I would think this probably is. And she just has a reflex, and what happens is all of a sudden it hits her eyes just like a sneeze. Her eyes get a little blurry, and it goes away, and it's weird.
Yeah.
It's definitely weird. It's very strange, but my guess is that somebody out there in our listening area has actually had the same thing and might actually have a cure for this, but I doubt if there's really
lucky
a
it's
cure.
Only for a second, because if you're driving and if this lasted a long time.
But what do you do when you're sneezing when you're driving? What happens if you're sneezing and you're driving in the car? Can't keep your eyes open when you sneeze.
Well, I was driving with someone else who sneezed and ran into a tree.
Oh, God, that's not good.
No.
That's not good. That's bad.
And took it to court.
Yeah.
And won. Yeah. Didn't have to pay the careless driving ticket.
Really? So took it to court.
The judge said, "I'm not going to, you know, make this blanket case so you, the insurance company, you
can
know,
get away from stuff."
But for your instance, I understand this, and I'm not going to make you pay the ticket.
Really? Yeah. So you didn't have to pay the ticket. Yeah. So did the judge give him an antihistamine?
No. This was somewhat after the fact. Think you can stump public radio's favorite family doc? Well, then send your lifestyle mysteries to the show in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We have our recipe coming up. It's a good one, a breakfast recipe, an unusual breakfast recipe. Some more of your calls, some more interesting research to talk about, our medical myth buster, all right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. That toll-free number again is 800-462-7413. Callers waiting, but a line open for you at 1-800-462-7413. Now, Zorba, before our next call, recipe time. This one, a breakfast recipe.
That's right, breakfast tortillas. This is a simple recipe. I mean, simple sometimes is really good. Simple means easy. You may use it more. You know, when we look at breakfast, we want to look at things, and I'm going to talk about it as we go through it, that may make things healthier and not healthier. And I think it's kind of thinking about breakfast, especially in the weekend when we're more likely to make a good breakfast, is something that's always kind of nice.
Yes. Okay.
You know, some variation of things. Now, what do you normally have for breakfast, Tom? What's your usual breakfast?
What? Every day, cereal.
Cereal. And then, but what do you do anything special on the weekend, or is it just
sometimes? You know, when I go out, I have bacon and eggs, toast, orange juice, coffee.
Yeah, at your favorite restaurant.
Yeah,
yeah. So, and I often will do that on a Saturday and Sunday. I never do it. I never do it in the middle of the week unless I'm meeting somebody. So these are breakfast tortillas. Okay, breakfast tortillas. Start out with half a tablespoonful of olive oil.
Half a big tea olive oil.
That's right. And then three small corn tortillas cut into strips.
Three small corn tortillas cut into strips?
Yeah, cut into strips. So you take the corn tortilla, and they have corn tortilla is really a heavier tortilla. It's different from a flour tortilla in the way that it feels. Anyone who's cooked Mexican knows that. And you cut into little strips. So just take little scissors.
So this is not something you're going to wrap around something and, and eat like a sandwich.
Right. You're not going to eat it like a sandwich.
Okay. All right. I get it.
Cut into strips. Four eggs beaten.
Four eggs beaten.
Now, if you have a heart disease, you know, and you're concerned about cholesterol, then what you're going to want to do, instead of having four eggs, you're going to have egg whites. But if you only have four, you're not going to have enough in there.
Well, you can eat those pretend eggs, too.
You can also eat the pretend eggs called egg beaters. Yeah. Have you ever had egg beaters?
They're good.
They actually taste pretty good. Yeah. So egg beaters are also quite good. Egg beaters, of course, have the protein from – I don't know what they put in them, but it has the it has the same protein, which is basically an egg white. Green chilies, what I would do is I would use a can of green chilies, either a green chili that is in the produce department, or you could use a canned green chili, about a quarter of a cup of green chilies diced.
Okay, quarter cup of green chili diced.
So when we dice chilies, what you want to do is take the seeds out if you want them not to be as hot, because the seeds carry the heat. And when you're done dicing them, what do you want to do with your hands?
Wash them.
Really, really good.
Before you scratch your eye,
you want to wash your hands. This is the voice of experience.
Yeah.
Exactly. An ounce of tomatilla salsa.
Ounce of tomatilla salsa.
That's right, which you'll get in a Hispanic section of your grocery store. Mm-hmm. Three tablespoonfuls of cilantro. If you don't like cilantro, I happen to like it, then use parsley. Parsley will work quite nicely.
Okay. Three parsley. Big tea, cilantro, or parsley.
You're gonna have some salt and pepper, of course.
S&P.
Of course. A small Roma tomato. Roma, of course, has a little bit more beefiness. Any tomato will work, but Roma has really a thicker, you know, has less pulp on the inside, and it's really a thicker tomato.
Okay. Small Roma tomato diced.
Then you're going to garnish it either with plain with low-fat sour cream, or you're going to garnish it with low-fat, non-flavored yogurt.
Okay.
So heat oil in a large skillet. That's only a half tablespoonful of olive oil. Add the tortilla strips. Cook them until softened. That's only going to be maybe 3 to 5 minutes. Then add the eggs, green chili, salsa, and cilantro. Cook for about 5 minutes until it sets. Season with salt and pepper. Top with diced tomatoes and a dollop of sour cream. And you've got a dynamite, quick, easy, wonderful breakfast that's fun to have and looks really good, especially because it has the green on top. You've got green on top. You've got the red of a tomato on top, and you've got the yellow of the eggs on top. So really, it looks nice. And
yeah,
presentation,
sounds good. Yeah.
Presentation matters.
Yeah.
It's really good.
Okay, and if you'd like this recipe, you can
come to our website, sorbapastor.org. You can find that recipe. You can go and find lots of other recipes. You can see what Tom looks like, what I look like. You can sign up for our weekly podcast. That's sorbapastor.org. And don't forget, you can find us on Facebook.
1-800-462-7413, our toll-free number. Back to the phone, Zorba, and a listener with us now in Spring Green, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi there.
How can we help?
About a week ago, got a pretty bad case of the flu. And this is more a question just for my own knowledge. I'm on the upswing. I'm healing finally. Mm-hmm. While I was sick, my throat was very sore. So the only things that were kind of palatable was carbonated water. Felt good on my throat, kept me hydrated. I wasn't really eating to anything really to speak of outside of maybe some toast or some soup. Mm-hmm. And then I got some orange juice. My partner brought me some orange juice to kind of help me out a little, keep me hydrated, and it was wonderful to have something with flavor and cold that didn't irritate my throat. Ice water or hot tea all kind of irritated my throat. So I was wondering if I was doing any harm taking in all of that sugar, which I don't normally do, or if it was sort of kind of a wash because I wasn't really eating either, if it was okay to be taking in that much sugar. I wasn't really taking in any calories to speak of.
Well, you bring up a really good point. So, you know, is sugar bad for us? No, sugar's not bad for us. Is sugar in large amounts bad for us? Yes, sugar in large amounts really is bad for us. Are sugar wasted? Is sugar a, quote, wasted calorie? Well, sugar is a calorie of energy. It's really important. It does give us energy, but sometimes Americans get too much energy, and so we lay it down as fat. And we are an obese society because we eat too much sugar, too much fat, too many carbohydrates, which, by the way, are converted into sugar. You eat a carb, you're basically eating sugar. It just doesn't taste like sugar. But in the body, it really does many, many of the same things, pretty much the same thing. So when you're sick and you're not eating, you really do need calories. That really is important. If you have a fever, you use a lot of calories. And so taking calories with a sweet drink, such as orange juice, is good, which, by the way, ounce for ounce, is roughly about as caloric as Coca-Cola. I mean, you could sit there and drink a can of Coke and sit there and drink a can of orange juice. You're pretty much getting the same calories. There's a nutritional difference. Obviously, Coke is Coke and orange juice is orange in it. But from a caloric point of view, it's about the same. So, no, I think you're doing yourself a good deed. I think when you're there, you're not eating and you're sick. You're in that sick place. You definitely want to get some calories in there, and it's okay to eat. But when people drink orange juice willy-nilly and think that, well, it's okay, it's orange juice, they're mistaken. It has calories, and you can eat, you know, you can get too much of a good thing. So, yeah, I drink orange juice when I'm sick. I don't tend to drink it a lot, but when I'm sick, I tend to drink orange juice. I think because it reminds me of my mother, you know.
Yeah.
You know, don't you associate your mom with orange juice?
Yeah, a little bit. Like, it was definitely a comfort food.
Absolutely. You know, my mother didn't know what a pomegranate
right.
was. She hardly knew what a squash was, but she knew what orange was and
right,
orange juice.
Right.
So, yeah, when you're sick, you do need those calories. So,
okay.
Yeah, I think you're doing good. You did the right thing.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you so much for your call.
We appreciate the call. 800-462-7413. To Hilliard, Florida now, Zorba. Hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Fine. What's up?
I'm trying to gain weight because I want to work out and pick up muscle. But my metabolism, I've been told, is extremely high. So I went to GNC, and they told me to start taking, like, heavy weight gain. Is there anything that I can take to that would actually help me build up the weight so that I can build it into muscle?
So I understand it. Are you working out?
Yes, I do work out, but not as often as I would like because I work pretty much 9 to 13 hours a day.
Oh, that's a lot of hours, 9 to 13 hours. What do you do for a living? Anything?
I deliver laundry at a resort.
Okay, so you're lifting things all the time, right?
Right.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's part of what you're doing. You're lifting heavy things.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You work out how many days a week?
Whenever I'm off, sometimes 2 to 3 days a week.
Okay, so 2 to 3 days a week. Are you lifting weights when you're working out?
Yes, I'm lifting weights, and I'm also doing cardio.
Okay, so you're doing cardio and you're lifting weights. Now, the GNC product you're talking about, that product was a supplement that you take every day. Was that the idea?
Correct.
Okay. So let me talk a little bit about that. First of all, some very interesting data that came out very recently where they took people in controlled situations and actually gave them too many calories. In other words, it was how do you gain weight? What they discovered was that people who eat more protein tend, if they gain weight, to gain more protein and more muscle mass. That was the bottom line of the study. In other words, if you eat a high-protein diet, you're more likely to put protein on in your body. All calories are not the same. In other words, so if you're going to add calories to your diet in order to try to gain weight, you want it to be protein calories. Now, I don't know what's in that specific product, but most of the products either have milk protein, whey protein, which is milk derived, or they have soy protein. And they're all pretty good. They're all really pretty good forms of protein. So adding that to a regime does make it, from my read, especially this recent study that showed the protein counts, more likely that you're going to put on muscle mass. But when you look at exercise and what you're doing and you want to put on muscle mass, it's a combination of what you eat and then how much you exercise. You still, because, as you said, you've got a high metabolism and 3 to 5% of the population wants to put on weight and has trouble putting on weight because, frankly, they don't eat as many calories. Yeah. And when you follow them, they're actually moving more. I mean, you probably, if you're a typical person who is thin, you're probably never sit in a chair and just hang out. Do you do that?
I can't sit still.
Yeah. You hit it. Yeah. and that's you can't sit still, and that's where your high metabolism is. You can't sit still. You're just always moving your body. Extra calories, 500 to 1,000 extra calories of protein, mostly protein, are going to make a difference for you.
Okay.
Good luck. Right. Thank you so much for calling.
We appreciate it. Just to be straight here, we can't eat our way to a muscular body.
No. By no means. You can't eat your way to a muscular body. You're going to put on protein. You've got to exercise. It's both together. And the reality is, as with this gentleman, he may succeed, but he may find he just can't eat that much. I mean, there are people who just can't eat enough to put the weight on. And they're left in the dust by the 70% of the people in the society, it seems, that want to lose weight.
Well, before we take another short break, Zorba, let's plow through a quick edition of Disagreeing with the Doc. Today's dissent comes to us from Larry in Green Bay, Wisconsin, who takes issue with your comments about milk. Don't worry, it's not about raw milk. Larry writes, Dr. Zorba, I am a dairy scientist from the dairy state, Wisconsin. On a past show, when you were explaining milk fortification with vitamin A and D, you stated incorrectly that milk is irradiated. Milk is not irradiated. Milk is pasteurized and homogenized, but milk is not irradiated.
I stand corrected.
If you're irritated or irradiated by Zorba's advice, let us know during our next edition of Disagreeing with the Doc. Just send your rebuttal to the show in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Coming up next, some interesting research to talk about. After that, more of your calls and our medical myth buster. Here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Our toll-free number again, 800-462-7413. But Zorba, before our next call, is Dad as likely to welcome his baby's cry as Mom?
Well, there's a whole concept that was really developed in the 70s and in the early 80s that mothers had an innate maternal instinct and they could recognize their cries. You know, in other words, you know, you put a bunch of babies in the room and they know which baby is actually crying and that, you know, dads don't have that maternal instinct.
Yeah.
And this study actually totally destroys that as a concept. And so this is the study. Very interesting study. 30 babies, okay, so 30 different families. And they looked at babies that are roughly about 2 months of age who were crying when they were being bathed. Okay, they're crying. They recorded the cries. The study took place in two places. It took place in France, mm-hmm. and it took place in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. And the reason is, in the Congo, men are often more involved with child raising than they are in France. Mm. Okay, so what they did was they gave the parents a bunch of different sounds of babies and said, which one is your baby? Yep. In other words, you're one baby crying, another baby crying, another baby crying. Here's what they found. The mothers, 98% of the time, they knew the cry of their child
okay.
from the other child. The dads, it was a function of how much time they spent with the child.
Oh.
The dads who spent 4 hours or more a day with the child were 90% accurate. Not 98%, but 90%. That's 9 out of 10.
Yeah.
I mean, that's good enough. The dads who only spent less than 4 hours a day, they still had some accuracy. They were 75% accurate.
Hmm.
So in other words, they weren't like 50% or 25%. They could still tell because both parents were raising the children.
Interesting. I'm thinking back. It's been a long time since my daughter was a baby. And I don't think I really could separate her cry off from any other
baby. Maybe you could.
But I didn't spend a whole lot of time.
You may have not spent time. But if we look at it, we were cooperative. You know, we cooperatively raise our children, certainly in a non-technological society. And this shows recognizing your baby's cry is a functioning of how often you hear the baby cry.
Right now, if you or I listen to 10, 12, 15 mm-hmm. different babies cry, we couldn't mm-hmm. separate one.
Oh, by no means, by no means. And my children are now older. They don't cry. But I recognize voices on the phone. You know, you get on the phone and somebody calls you up. Well,
but that's,
when
that's
you're
different than a baby's
not
cry.
At all. Some babies have a high cry. Some babies have a different cry. The cry is basically a communication to the parent. And this study shows that it's not maternal instinct that's doing it. It's listening to the cry, responding to the cry. Parenting is part of the cry. You know, parenting with the child will let you identify the cry. And once again, it shows that during early childhood of development, bonding goes hand in hand with being with your child.
1-800-462-7413, our toll-free number. And a listener now, Zorba in Kingman, Kansas. Hi.
Hello, gentlemen. How are you?
Fine. How can we help?
Well, I'm needing a little bit of a judgment from the great Zorba, if I might. My wife and my youngest son both suffer from strabismus. They are both quite pronounced. My wife's is to the outside, and my youngest son, who is now in first grade, is to the inside. My wife had surgery done as a child to correct this. This was, well, she's 35. Don't tell anybody I said that.
Okay.
The secret is safe with us.
Super. My son, of course, is 6, and I'm very, very concerned that he's going to have the self-esteem issues as he becomes older that she has now. I'm certain today that they're able to address that issue better than they were in the past. And she's fighting me every step of the way because, you know, there's costs involved. There's pain involved. It's a process. And she doesn't think that there's going to be an outcome in the positive way. She's afraid it's going to happen just like it happened to her when she was a child.
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, number one, that was 35 years ago. Well, it wasn't 35 years ago because then she'd be older.
Right,
but we're talking about a couple of decades ago. And as with many surgical techniques in medicine, but certainly eye surgical techniques, they have improved. So the first thing that I think is important is how do you actually relate that to your wife in a way? And how does she look at things so that you can make a decision for your child? Now, for your child, if there's something that you can do for your child to correct this, it's something you really want to do from a cosmetic point of view and also from a point of view of eyesight. You know, having eyesight that's called conjugal is really better than having strabismus. So my recommendation is that – now, have you seen an ophthalmologist or an eye doctor? Have you brought your son anywhere, or is this just in the talking phase?
We're in the talking phase now. My mother is actually an ophthalmic assistant and swears that they can address it and address it so that
and your wife?
Corrected.
So you've got your mother on one side and your wife on the other side. How do you finesse that?
Very carefully.
That's exactly it. So one of the things that I recommend with people, especially when they're anxious in a situation like this, is go to a reliable center. Find an ophthalmologist who does lots of these. In other words, what you want is somebody who does a lot of them, not just a few of them, but that is, you know, the strabismus guru, if you would, in your local area. And going and asking an optometrist or an optician or asking an optical assistant who that might be is one way to start. Another way would be to go to a university center. And I think what you ought to do is go there and with your son. Get an evaluation, and that is at least information where you can start at. Your son is 5, so he's going to look at it, and he's part of it too. You know, he's part of the fact that he may want to get rid of it himself. 5-year-olds have the ability to make decisions. I remember my kids when they were 5. But I think you've got to go to a center there. I wouldn't give it up. The reality is it's 2 decades better. Is it 100%? And the answer is no. It's not 100%. But will it be improved? Yes. And might it be 100%? With surgery, yes. It could be 100%. Without surgery, it won't be 100%.
Okay.
So you have to do that. And don't tell your wife that you said she was 35.
Oh, I won't. I promise I'll take that to the grave.
But that's how you handle it. These can be very difficult situations. And like you said, you finesse it between your wife, you know, and your mom very carefully. And that way, that may mean that you're going to go to somebody who is completely different from who your mom works with. And I'm sure your mom would be just okay with that, too.
Okay, super.
Good luck.
Thank you very much, gentlemen.
And
thanks.
Thank you so much for the call. Now, he called you Zorba the Great. Do you want to incorporate
right.
that into
great.
Our show on a regular basis?
I think it's great.
Would you like me
to
refer to
you? Zorba the Great on your health. I like it. Zorba the Great. That's exactly it. I like that. 800-462-7413.
Zorba, let's get to our medical myth buster now. We have a listener myth today from Greg in Bloomington, Indiana, who heard some contradicting news about some common health advice about aspirin. Greg writes, I listen to and trust your advice. Please help us figure this out. A study from St. George's of London says there's very little benefit of a daily aspirin for healthy people and maybe a health risk. And I remember hearing about this just lately.
Oh, yeah. And it's a very interesting – it's an interesting study. First of all, there are people from the Aspirin Institute Foundation who believe the study isn't real. Now, I didn't even know there was an Aspirin Institute or foundation. Do you think that could be industry supported? Well, possibly, possibly?
I didn't know about it either, but I'm not surprised
that
it exists.
I wouldn't be surprised.
And,
I'm not surprised they exist, and they might be.
And I'm sure there's no bias whatsoever.
I'm sure there's no bias
at
the Aspirin Institute. But this was an article that was published in the Archives of Internal Medicine. Good journal, good research, good article. This was out of the University of London. They looked at 100,000 healthy people who took aspirin. Now, these are not people who have known heart disease and have had a heart attack. If you've had one heart attack or a stroke, we know taking aspirin is worthwhile. But we've made a decision that something called primary prevention is also worthwhile. Why not take it before you get the heart attack so you won't get the heart attack?
Right.
And that's what they looked at. So they looked at 100,000 people and they looked at how many people didn't get heart attacks and they looked at, or strokes, at how many people then had non-trivial bleeding. In other words, your hands bleed a little bit. That's trivial. But you've got a big – you know, you've got something in your hand which is, we'll say, a big hematoma, a big swelling in the hand from that. That's non-trivial. And they found that indeed that there were a fair number of people who would have both. So they estimated that one stroke or one heart attack was averted for every 120 people who took an aspirin. Mm-hmm. Okay, you take roughly 100 people who take aspirin. You get rid of one heart attack and one stroke. That's fine. But they also discovered that one out of seven 73 people had non-trivial bleeding. So we've got lots and lots of data on on aspirin. And in my mind, there's a lot of research that's going on now. And I wouldn't take this one study and then make a decision of the fact that we shouldn't be taking aspirin, because I still think it's worthwhile. On the other hand, this does show that there are significant side effects to aspirin that we have not taken into account. Mm-hmm. And that's where I think sitting down with your doc when you go in for an annual physical or a bi or a triannual, yeah, and saying, should I be on aspirin or not? Let's look at the, yeah, data, and you make a decision. Yeah. There's a benefit there, no doubt about it, but there's a risk there, no,
okay,
doubt.
Well, I'm
that.
Sitting down with my doc now.
Should I take aspirin? Yes. You should take at least.
Thank you.
At least an
Thank
aspirin.
You,
that's
Dr.
right. That's right. You're welcome. You're welcome. I've given my advice now.
Send me the
now,
bill.
Send me right. I was going to say, show me the money.
Back to the phones we go, Zorba. A listener with us now in Bozeman, Montana. Hi.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What's up?
I'm a 58-year-old male, in remarkably good health, no blood pressure, no cholesterol. Long story short, this winter I kind of came down with an ailment that I self-diagnosed and named it myself as the dwindles. A little bit depressed, but not too bad. A little bit mentally fuzzy, but not too bad. Couldn't lose weight, even though I was exercising and dieting. And I was more existing than living. I didn't care about some things. Anyway, went to the doctor, had my thyroid looked at, which was normal, and then she suggested a testosterone level, which was low. So she prescribed a shot in the old hind end once a month, 400 milligrams of testosterone. And I had my first one 3 weeks ago. Sleeping like a log. The rest of the symptoms are getting better. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, a nosy friend who probably doesn't know what he's talking about told me that testosterone shots were not ideal because there was the high level at the start of the month and then a low blood level towards the end of the month, and that I would be better off on a gel or a patch. Does Zorba have an opinion?
Well, first of all, there are a lot of things that are going on. Just because you have a low testosterone level doesn't mean you need testosterone. I want to lay that absolutely clear, that this concept of male menopause is, if you will, fomented by the testosterone industry, which produces the gel and the patch, which costs roughly about $150 to $200 a month, very expensive. And they also have shown research that they get a more regular blood level and that the injections, which are cheaper, by the way, are not as good as the patch. And there's no evidence that one is better than another, first of all, with replacement, none at all. You do get – it's called a depot injection. You do have a higher level at the beginning of the month, but – we don't know what that means. We don't know whether that means anything. Now, I want to talk about your symptoms. What happens is there's always a placebo effect, not always, but about a third or 40% of the time when we get shots. So you can get a shot.
As long as it works.
As long as it works. But you can get – well, that's very true. That's very true. The placebo effect tends to disappear over a period of days to weeks to months. So in other words, after about 2 months or 3 months, if it's a placebo effect, it's going to generally disappear, not always. So over time, the placebo effect often becomes less and less and less. So you might be having a placebo effect from the shots or you might not. And these are really – kind of the questions that have to be answered. You've had a lot of the symptoms that may be associated with low testosterone, which are really quite real in some men, but we don't have a way of really evaluating that. So I think staying on the shots, and if your insurance pays for the gel and the patch and you want to go to that, you certainly can do that. But staying on the shots maybe for 3 to 6 months, seeing whether or not you continue to have a difference with that, that may make a difference.
So after 3 to 6 months, we're going to know if it's a placebo effect or what I call Dumbo's feather.
Much more likely that it's correct to know if it's placebo or Dumbo's feather. Exactly.
So, all right. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Sure, thanks.
You're welcome.
We appreciate the call. And before we check out for the week, Zorba, let's take care of a little Zorba Pastor and Your Health grammar police business. This might be a grammar police first. Our anonymous deputy both fines you and vindicates you in the same email on your past advice for dry eyes. I'll let them take over from here, writing, "Hey, when you use the word aesthetic relating to someone's eye drops, you may have gotten it wrong. You advised the person to try different brands of eye drops until he or she found one that was aesthetically pleasing. I think you meant one that works for the problem, but what you said was one that looks good." Here would be the defense for why you didn't use the wrong word. When the person with dry eyes is in front of you, you're looking at somebody squinting and rubbing eyes and doing all kinds of distracting moves. What is aesthetically pleasing to the observer is someone who has found the right eye drops, not doing those unappealing gyrations. Ta-da! You weren't wrong after all.
I love it. I love it. But to declare what I actually was talking about is that we like a certain texture. People like textures on their skin and in drops. So some people like a drop that is oilier, greasier, and firmer. And some people like a drop that is more watery.
Okay.
Just like some people may prefer an ointment versus a cream.
Okay.
So when we talk about aesthetics with eye drops, there are differences in how they feel in the eye.
But that's not aesthetically how you look.
I think they're right. And so I wanted to clarify that, and I will take the compliment and the reprimand.
But you don't agree that you misspoke on us.
No, I do agree that I misspoke.
Oh, you did. Oh, okay.
Absolutely. I do agree.
I thought you don't want to argue with the listener.
No. Tom, me argue? Never. Never. That's not a I'm Mr. Touchy-feely, happy-go-lucky, thank you very much. I do exactly what you say, guy.
And you like to cuddle.
Yes, I do, Tom.
Well, if Zorba's grammar mistakes bug you, or if they aren't really mistakes at all, join the Zorba Pastor on Your Health Grammar Police by sending an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We'll see you next week, Zorba.
Stay well, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our show podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org. Or don't forget, you can find us on Facebook.
Don't forget, you can call us anytime at 1-800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. Adam, the Earl of Grantham Friedrich, and his loyal technical director,
His Excellency.
Yeah, Brad, Mr. Bates Kohlberg are the two
Mr. Bates.
Mountain dudes responsible for this hour. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidrin. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, hoping you'll be with us for the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0525Z. More information on Zorba, his clinic, and healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, and show archives, is available online at ZorbaPastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.